Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I get to speak with Dr. Maria Haim, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Religion at Amherst College. We'll be speaking about a brand new Princeton University Press publication, Words for the Heart, A Treasury of Emotions from Classical India. Maria, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Raj.
So you'll have to tell us, how did you get into emotion, the study of emotion or thinking about emotion?
Yeah, well, most of my work before this book was really centered on, or at least in the last couple of decades, centered on, I guess you could say, the moral psychology of Pali Buddhism. Been very immersed in the Abhidhamma tradition and particularly the work of Buddhaghosa, this 5th century Pali Buddhist thinker. And so for a long time, I've been interested in psychology and emotions and intentions and motivations and a whole range of types of things. And I've published work on particular emotions within the Pali tradition. But I hadn't necessarily figured out how to talk about emotion more broadly within the Indic tradition. And so this book came about where I was finished with a lot of the Buddhaghosa work, needing to come out of this kind of deep immersion in one system and one thinker and one obsessive kind of deep dive into him. And I encountered Tiffany Watt Smith's little book. It's called The Book of Human Emotion, and she's an emotions researcher. And she had drawn together emotion words from all different languages and all different traditions and sort of put together a cute little book of anecdotes about different emotions. And I began to wonder, maybe this is what I need to kind of go wide instead of deep into one thinker. And how could I gather up some of the many emotion words I've encountered in the Indian sources over the decades? And then it really occurred to me that this idea of a kosha, a treasury, which is, of course, an Indian genre, might be a great way to gather them up. So a kosha can be a thesaurus. We have Amara's kosha, a word book. But it can also be a collection of poems or short literary pieces or philosophical reflections. And so it seemed to be the right idea for what I wanted to do. I didn't want to write a dictionary. I didn't want to write an encyclopedia or something comprehensive. But I liked the particularist approach or a lexical kind of approach. By looking closely at particular words, I could draw out some of the nuance and the thinking in Indian sources quite broadly. So I really began to run, as you can see in the book, with this treasury metaphor, you know, that these are gems drawn from all different sort of mined from all different sources and in Indian thought, very broadly conceived. And so I had the great privilege and luxury of just reading across every genre. It has Buddhist sources in it, of course, but also the epics and I drew heavily from rasa theory. I looked at a lot of Shastra. I looked at a lot of philosophical texts. I looked at many different kinds of poems. I got into medical texts. So it was this wonderful opportunity to kind of just read really widely and gather up things that I thought were beautiful or fascinating and collect them in this treasury.
No, you ended just now on a great place to segue into the process, right? There's so much to choose from. What was that journey like for you in terms of deciding what to allocate where, what to include or not, ways in which you were thinking of emotion or emotionality?
Yeah, so a really great question. I kind of early settled on, I really feel that this English word emotion is very restricted in some ways. It's probably not a term we can live without. And it kind of, opens up the kinds of phenomena I want to look at. But I didn't want to heavily police emotions. There's a whole literature in Western philosophy about what constitutes an emotion, the kind of ontological questions about emotion. And I see this word emotion is very shallow historically. For most of English, in the history of the English language, people did not use this word emotion. It's very recent. So it's parochial and it's provincial, and it has a lot more to do with modern English speakers than anything carved in nature or anything we see sort of historically deep, even in the Western tradition, to say nothing of the Indian traditions, where we have very different meta categories and very different conceptions. And so I needed this word emotion, but I didn't want to be too tethered to it. So as I tried to talk about in my introduction, I really kind of looking at emotion-like words, dispositions, moods, very broadly conceived, and didn't want to have a lot of strictures around that. And then in terms of how I found things, I started with things that I already knew. So I started with a lot of terms and that I've already either written about or been interested in from Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist psychology. Probably the most pleasurable part of the project was just going back and reading things I hadn't read, since graduate school, perhaps, or had only read in passing or only dipped into once in a while. So I read, and we have these wonderful, the Clay Sanskrit Library and all of the materials coming out with the Murthy Classical Library of India and many other sources. And so I read a lot of stuff in translation, which was just a treat to read across literature in so many different ways. And so I really followed the wonderful translations of so many scholars in our field. And when something would jump out at me, I'd wonder, oh, what is the Sanskrit word for that? Or what is, and then I'd go back and find it. And then that would become an entry. So a lot of it, I would say that was the most fun part of the treasury, was that just discovery. Reading a lot of stuff and looking for words. And then I felt like I had to do some work that, like, if I hadn't encountered them, like I had to, there are just some terms we have to deal with. I had to deal with words for craving, trishna. I had to deal with, the gunas, not had to deal with, but I had to go in and research particular terms. And so I went on basis of my instincts where, what we might imagine, where I might go to look for some of these terms. So there was a research element of it too, of just trying to track down who has a good discussion of particular terms that I would want to draw from. But as you may know, or at least what I try to say in the introduction, is that I'm not trying to be comprehensive or encyclopedic or generic. It's really more
generative.
It's more to be generative. I'm much more interested not in conveying any notion that I'm getting at, a basic notion of these emotions or a generic notion of them. I'm rather much more interested in the poignant anecdote or the story or the philosophical nugget that pulls out or even evokes an emotional experience, rather than trying to speak of emotions, of these terms in general, in very general ways. So that was, it's a little idiosyncratic. It is, I shouldn't say a little, it is idiosyncratic. It's quirky, and it's, other people would have come up with different emotion terms and certainly different passages if they were doing something of the same project. But I'm hoping that readers find pleasure in some of these terms, or find new ideas, or that maybe this even begins to open up the study of emotions and it for, you know, Indian text or scholars of Indian texts further. So it wasn't meant to be entirely, you know, a systematic research project. It was also, it was meant from the beginning to be something that was fun
and creative,
crosses over into a more general readership than any of my other work has done.
Oh, without question, it lends itself to more general readership, people interested in ideas and experiences and all things Indic. You know, I completely understand why the word emotion is used, because it's, you know, it's a great shorthand in English to point to, you know, something much more oceanic, you know, and yet, of course, it's so much more than what we think of as emotions in English. And, you know, to me, you know, I have papers that say I know religion or Sanskrit narrative, but I'll be really honest, in my heart of hearts, my core expertise in this life is people, you know, how people work, you know, what drives them, personal growth work. And really, so many of the entries, to my mind, they really get at the guts of the human experience, what we think of as the human experience, what humans experience palpably and subjectively interacting with the world and others. So certainly it's wonderfully atypical for an academic publication, and probably well received by a larger audience. But just to give listeners a sense, I mean, there are, if I'm not mistaken, 177 entries, and just randomly, I'll just pick one randomly here. Pushti, satisfaction. Okay, we've all had the experience of satisfaction, perhaps, one would hope. But this is, gives you a sense of what an entry might be like. Satisfaction in the sense of contentment is usually a good thing. Si santosha. But when it becomes complacency, it can hinder progress and development. So it's wonderfully anchored. The experience is anchored in something of an Indic mindset or an attitude towards, you know, a spiritual growth. And it goes on to mention some of satisfactions that delimit impede, restrain our potential for growth, and some that actually support it. So it's rich, right? There's emotionality, there's philosophy, there's spirituality. What do you see as the primary purpose or purposes of the book? Like, what do you hope it would affect?
Well, for me, it will be enough if readers find pleasure in the entries. It really is meant to be, you know, if I succeed in any way bringing out something, you know, deep gut level with human experience, it's only because I'm following these Indian texts and how they're doing it. So that to me is, you know, that'll be a win if people find something and find entries that speak to them as human beings, and show that the incredible nuance and texture with which Indian texts have got at that. So that's my main goal, actually. And so in that sense, I think of it as kind of almost like a literary text. If it winds up, you know, stimulating more work and emotions. I mean, I've been surprised as I've kind of been looking at a range of different scholarly works, partly to create this project, is how few times you can open the index and find the word emotion, or open the index and find particularly emotion words of any of our scholarship, right? It just hasn't been thematized. We thematize other things that aren't part of the linguistic world of ancient India. We thematize religion. That's a completely Western construct. We thematize ethics. We can thematize law. We thematize so many different things, but we haven't thematized emotion. And seeing how deeply, you know, how deeply it's operating in the mind, you know, in the works and the stories and the narratives from India. So if it by thematizing this word emotion or related words, it helps to generate further research, then that would also be a win for me.
Were there particular surprises in your research, or terms that sort of stayed with you or stuck out in your mind, or you saw differently through this project?
One word that I spent quite a bit of time thinking about is sukha. So this is a word for pleasure or happiness or bliss. And one of the things that I just sort of got really deeply into, maybe even my sukha entry got a little bit too long, but what I was fascinated with is that in the Pali sources, the Pali Buddhist sources, sukha really is a term for nirvana. But it's also, readers will know, or Sanskrit and Pali scholars will know that sukha is also kind of the opposite of dukkha. So it just means pleasure. And so one of the things that I began to see as I tried to chart it or trace it in the Pali Suttas is the extent to which the Buddha is being extremely playful with this word sukha. On the one hand, rejecting sukha, pleasure, as the kind of pleasure that's based in desire, the satisfaction of desire. On the other hand, talking about sukha by changing its meaning, sometimes in the very same passage, to refer to nirvana, a kind of happiness that has nothing to do with the satisfaction of desire. And so there's some very sublime passages in the Pali Suttas about this, where, for example, the Buddha as a young man, before he had really even begun his religious quest, he was still living in the palace, but he has this experience under a jambu tree where he sits down and he experiences what some of the jhanas, these advanced meditation states. And then he pulls out of it and he wonders, well, why am I afraid of these kinds of sukha that have nothing to do with the satisfaction of or the gratification of desire? So he pulls out of, why am I afraid of that? And then his next thought is, I am not afraid of the sukha that has nothing to do with sensual desire. And so there's a kind of really interesting kind of work that he's doing with happiness. And dukkha gets all the attention in the early Buddhist stuff, that it's all about dukkha and getting rid of suffering. But the flip side of it, of course, is this idea of sukha. And then you have moments where the Buddha's followers will ask him, how could nirvana be sukha? What kind of sukha involves no pleasure, no gratification? And the Buddha will just say really sublime things, just that, monks, that nirvana doesn't involve pleasure. That itself is this happiness I'm talking about. So I got kind of into that for a while. I've been very interested also in just beautiful things that popped up. I love the Bhava Bhuti's treatment of Chakshuraga. This is a little thing. I love Chakshuraga. And he talks about, I love is what people who have some kind of relationship that's maybe written in the stars, when their eyes first meet, they discover a deep love. And I think that Bhava Bhuti's treatment of this is so beautiful, and the way that he talks about how, because the poets have taught us this word, I love, we know it's real. And so that's some of the thinking that's going on in some of the texts, particularly the kavya material and the literary aesthetics, that the poets give us terms that that make reality. They teach us what's real. They bring into being what is real. And that's deeply part of Bhava Bhuti's thought. But it pops up in these wonderful ways with emotion terms, that when we have a term for emotion, then we can then experience it. So these are just a couple of examples of things that I was thinking about this morning. What would I talk about as some of my favorite moments of discovery? But I can talk about more, but I'm sure you have other questions.
Much like the book itself, I've said this comment probably half a dozen times, that my question's always meant to be generative more than limiting. And so it's about the conversation. Just to give listeners another taste, here's another randomly vihara. Vihara isn't an emotion. It's a condition. But it is a condition so saturated with feeling that it must be included among our treasures. Vihara is the state of being separated from the one you love. And in Sanskrit letters, it is ground zero of the deepest longing, anguish, and despair of the human heart as it pines for the distant lover. Vihara is the condition that makes possible the agonizing relish that is vipralamba, love in separation. It's lovely. Lovely. I can envision a number of applications for this type of work. But I wonder, certainly there'll be a variety of responses to this, but who do you think this is most for? Who might most benefit from having a look at this kind of work?
Well, I don't know who will benefit or in benefit in what way, but I did want from the beginning, so I'm sort of straddling two horses in a complicated way, because I did want this to be accessible to a general readership. So I really wanted to keep some of the jargon and the sense, you know, the deep apparatus. I mean, every entry, as you know, from looking at it, has, you know, I give references for it, but I'm not just pulling this stuff out of thin air. It comes from particular texts that I wanted scholars to be able to track down and look at for themselves. So that was deeply important to me. But my first audience was always a general readership, that people who maybe who are interested in emotions from other traditions. So I've been doing some work with classicists who are interested in, you know, expanding in a more global vision of what work on is emotions, or people who are doing emotions research in different areas could pick up my book on Indian material and get access to it and see the richness here and see the possibilities here. So I wanted that audience. I wanted people who are generally interested in India, but are not necessarily scholars, but who know the epics or want to know more about yoga traditions or Buddhism or something, that they could pick it up and get access to some of these ideas. So that's the difference, you know. So I don't know, you know, who of those is, you know, gonna, you know, how this will sit. I really don't know how it's gonna land or who it's gonna benefit, if it benefits anybody. But I do hope that these different kinds of audiences will find something in it, just because of the diversity and the range of things I'm talking about, that might make them think about human experience in fresh ways. That would be my hope.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, having produced this book and spent a fair bit of time researching and thinking about these, the word bhava comes to mind, you know, these moods, mindsets, modes, right? These emotions, broadly conceived. Do you, in your particular perspective, see in the Indic tradition that there are certain emotions that are harped on or fleshed out in a way that may not be so in our sort of modern Western mindset? I mean, what strikes you about this in the Indic context?
I lean pretty heavily into rasa theory, which was a great pleasure for me to kind of think about some of India's systems approaches or systematic approaches. So it's not just here's a bunch of words, it's also what does rasa theory, where we see Indian thought, you know, thinkers kind of theorizing their own experience, particularly in the realm of aesthetics, you know, what can they teach us? And so the word bhava, of course, is such bigger than emotion, ways of being, I think it might be how I translate it. So some of the entries are bringing out kind of these bigger theoretical systems that I think that would be good for, the treatment of aesthetics and Bharata's texts and his successors and the literary traditions is such a fascinating treatment of aesthetic, not just aesthetic experience, but also philosophical anthropology of what humans are like emotionally, in ways that I think scholars are just beginning to sort of explore. But in terms of words that we just don't have anything for in English, or that, you know, that they give, the carve up experience so differently, and that are but deep preoccupations in the Indic traditions, I like some of the vocabulary of kleshas, kleshas are these kind of depravities or afflictions that that not just Buddhist thinkers, but also all the ascetic traditions are grappling with in one way or another. How do you get rid of deep-seated negative emotions? Another related word is asavas in the Pali tradition, a word that I translate in its most literal way, oozings. So that we have these kleshas and oozings. Asavas are deeply seated emotional, temperamental dispositions that are have been in part of our experience from the beginning of time, right? They come to us from across lives. And they have to be uprooted. They have to be, you know, how do you get rid of them? So it's both a kind of deeply grim picture of what human beings are like in some way. We've got anger and we have ignorance, we have delusion, we're just driven by lust and greed in really deep ways. But it's also an extraordinarily optimistic picture that actually nirvana or moksha is complete eradication of these dispositions that I think maybe other psychologies take to be fundamental and basic to human our human endowment. So I think that kind of stuff. I think some of the words I have in there in vasanas and the samskaras, this deep, this idea of deep traces on us from the distant past, that is pretty important to the religious literatures, but also a deeply important kind of poetic conceit, as we know from that very, very beautiful verse that's quoted all over the place in the recognition of Shakuntala, where the vasanas are those deep memory traces from the past, so that when Dushyanta has forgotten Shakuntala, he hears beautiful music that that reminds him of a distant lover in the past that he's forgotten because he hears something beautiful. And so what sometimes the religious and ascetic literatures are quite disapproving of how deep our dispositions run, the poets pick up with great beauty to think about, I think, perhaps the most romantic conceit ever, that that love is picking up something that was there in a distant past. And that beauty and beautiful music and beautiful poetry can bring it forward for us. So that kind of stuff, I think we get just a very different psychology than we have in the Western tradition that that opens up possibilities for what we might think about.
Are there certain texts or genres of texts in particular that you rely on for the book?
So I do a lot with the epics. So you'll see a lot of material from the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, which I think are great studies of human experience. And I do a lot, as I just mentioned, with rasa theory. Bharata not only gives us this early text about dramaturgy. Bharata, maybe third or fourth century, wrote this book on dramaturgy, the Natya Shastra, that gives us a whole theory about, it's not entirely clear how it all works, but the rudiments of a theory about the relationship of human emotional experience and the refinement of that into rasa or kind of aesthetic experience. And so in that he has a deep treatment of a lot of emotion words, lots of definitions in them. And this inaugurates a whole millennium and beyond of further exploration of these terms and how they produce and how aesthetic experience is produced. So I lean very heavily into that. But of course, I'm also working on the Buddhist psychology, particularly the Abhidhamma, Abhidharma traditions, in which you also have extremely meticulous disaggregation of human experience into, you know, very long lists of terms, not all of which are emotions, but some of which are, that are all interacting. So it's a kind of analytical approach to experience, to break it down into smaller bits and then to see how those smaller bits of experience interact. And so that to me was like another really important systems approach to work with. So and then I was just after that, just looking at literature, reading the wonderful translations of so many of our colleagues, you know, who do beautiful work on poetry, David Shulman and Sheldon Pollack and Martha Selby and others that just, you know, that give us a lot of pleasure.
Brilliant translators you mentioned. I will say there's something utterly alluring about the work of David Shulman. We hope to have him on the podcast soon. Speaking of folks we've had on the podcast, my last guest happened to be Chakravarti Ramprasad. And you each acknowledge each other in your forewords. It was fascinating. Is this work that you will continue in some sense?
Yeah, so I've had a really productive set of conversations with Ram Prasad about all of these texts. And he was actually very extremely helpful for me in terms of he knows the Indian tradition so well. So he could point me to particular, you know, areas that I needed to look at and kind of, I think he saved me probably from a lot of gaffes and mistakes I would have otherwise had in the book. But we've also worked with another colleague, Roy Zohar, in Israel on a volume together that was a kind of a Bloomsbury handbook of emotions. So we've had a conversation for some time about how to carve out this area of emotions research and what that might look like. So that's been really productive. More of his work has been on sort of bodily experience, although now he's turning to emotions. I think in kind of working more systematically than my kind of lexical approach did. But in terms of my further directions, I'm not sure where I'm going to go with. Right now, I'm very deeply into translating. So I've had the privilege of being asked to translate the Melinda Panha, the Questions of King Melinda, which is a really important Buddhist text that kind of describes a conversation, perhaps an imagined conversation, or perhaps a real conversation between a Greek king and a Buddhist monk in the first century or so BCE. I'm doing that for the Murti Classical Library of India. So I've been working on that. And I've discovered that I really love translation and I really like translating. So I think I'm kind of taking a little break right now, but I think, you know, where I want to go next is with more translation work. And part of that was because of the treasury, I got to follow so many choices people made about translation. I learned a huge amount from seeing how translations work and then trying to figure out how I could, you know, think about them within my own framework of the treasury. And so just learning that from people like David Shulman and so many others was good for my thinking about what the whole business of translation is.
I'm so glad to hear actually that you'll be applying, because it just occurred to me, that, you know, that you must have internalized so much about the process. So I'm really glad to hear you'll be consciously and unconsciously applying that in rendering translations for us. But could you say just a word about your process, if you've had one? Like, what's the translation process like for you?
Well, again, I had never really seen myself as a translator, right? So I'm just figuring this out. I had seen myself more working in philosophy. So the whole turn to the literary has been and developing a literary sensibility and has been part of, I mean, I think you're right to say that I internalized a lot when doing the treasury, and I hadn't seen that that would be an outcome, but it has helped me. So all I can speak of is how I've been working on the Melinda Panha, the Questions of Melinda. And I find it to be absolute wonderful pleasure. I mean, what's nice about it is you're not casting out there with your own argument. You're following somebody else. You're just trying to put the right words and the right ideas into place. And so I've actually found it to be a more calming practice than a lot of our scholarly, you know, argument-driven work that we do. And I find that it has its own pacing. And as long as you're coming to it regularly and you set aside time to get in there, if it's one paragraph a day, that's amazing. You know, if you can get a page or two a day, you know, or a page or two a week, that's amazing. You know, but so it has its own kind of pacing as long as you're just keeping the game as you follow along. And with the Melinda Panha, it's brought me into all kinds of other things. Like, so this is a text that ranges across Buddhist philosophy, but also so many other places of Indian thought and ancient India. I've had to research the flora and the fauna and the kinds of food people eat. And, you know, so I never know one day to the next what I'm going to have to plunge into to figure out what he's talking about. So that also has been just kind of nice to to just be following a lot, you know, following a thinker and trying to understand him and trying to put it into English. And it just, I don't know, I don't want to stop translating. That's what I sort of figured out. I don't know if I'll ever write any other kind of book again. I hope to just keep translating.
Brilliant. I find it so, you know, clearly as scholars, our left brains work, one would hope, fairly well, compared to the average bear, perhaps. And yet monographs, the best monographs are the ones, in my particular view, that exhibit a fair bit of creativity and storytelling and presentation. Whether the scholar has a flair for literature or not, there will inevitably be an umsha, a pinch of literary pizzazz in their work for it to be accessible and whole in some sense. So for me, producing scholarship is creative, but it's primarily analytic. And translating is the opposite, where it's primarily creative with a whole bunch of analysis going in and thinking. And I've been wonderfully spoiled such that the my primary objects of study that Ramayana has been translated by the Goldman Project. Coburn's done a solid translation of the Devi Mahatmya that I quote even in both my books. And it's only in the past 6 months or so that I've sat down and I've churned out a translation, a new translation of the Devi Mahatmya.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wonderful.
Where, you know, to my mind, I thought, oh, well, it's been done. Like, you know, but really it's been 30 years. And, you know, it's from some encouragement from some colleagues and some demands from some students. Apparently it's time. So I've turned out a new translation, and the process is so, it's just different. It's just such a different process. I mean, what do you do when you taste something in a verse, but it's not in any of the words in that verse? Do you add an adjective in English because that's what you feel you need to add? And yet if somebody was directly comparing the Sanskrit to the English, wait a minute, that adjective isn't there in the Sanskrit. You know, at what point do you sacrifice the literary from what you perceive to be what you taste? It's palpable to you, the verses mm-hmm. sort of saying. And we'll see how well those translations received. I actually did a little bit, I did a recent public book called The Stories Behind the Poses, where there was 50 vignettes from the Puranas and the epics. But that was, you know, a lot of that was rendering and retelling. It was just, you know, looking over the Sanskrit or going over from memory, a bit of both, and literally telling it as I would tell it in a class, but in a more literary and sustained manner. But perhaps at some point we'll have a podcast dedicated to the perils and the beauty of translation.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I've said too much, clearly. Is there anything else about the book that you hoped we touch on today?
Not that I can think of. I think that's probably much of what I wanted to hopefully have come through. I do appreciate your comments on translation. It does feel like a different part of our work. And how do you produce a translation that is true to the text, but also works in English? And so one of the things I've learned from the Murti is that you have to, I think that we don't need to follow Sanskrit syntax. We don't have to have these kind of convoluted, you know, passive voice constructions. We really do need to follow English syntax and make it live in English. So it's really an art, I think, more than a science, of how you get the meaning and you're not adding too much, but you're also making it work in a completely different linguistic world.
Fascinating and appropriate place to end. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj. I really appreciate it.
For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Maria Haim on a brand new, fascinating, rich publication called Words for the Heart, A Treasury of Emotions from Classical India. It's brand new, Princeton University Press. Check it out. I think you might be surprised what you learn about ancient India, Indic philosophy, spirituality, and the human experience itself. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating emotions across cultures. Take care.